This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Socialism is having a moment in America. Maybe it's more than a moment. Maybe there's a movement out there. For decades, calling someone a socialist was an insult. Now there are politicians who wear the Democratic Socialist badge proudly. Some of them are winning elections. Polls are showing favorables for socialism, growing favorables and growing negatives for capitalism. That's causing some hyperventilation in the right chatter sphere. So what to make of this? Do you think it's time to give socialism a chance, or do you think socialism is still a bad word and let's keep it that way? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. And you can email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. Our guest this hour, we're joined by Stephanie Mulch. She is a sociology professor, expert on socialism and social democracy at UC Davis, author of Leftism Reinvented, Western Parties from Socialism to Neoliberalism. Paul Gregory is with us, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, holds an endowed professorship in the Department of Economics at the University of Houston. Elizabeth Brunig is here. She's an opinion columnist with the Washington Post. It's great to have three of you here this afternoon. We're going to have an exciting discussion trying to sort of figure out where we're going with socialism in America. Also, I want to make a correction in the opening billboard. I had said that Bernie Sanders was from New Hampshire. Of course, he's from Vermont. And let's get a call. This is from our voicemail line, and this is from Kenneth.
Hi, my name's Kenneth, and I would gladly pay more taxes for everybody in this nation to get health care and quality education. I think it's criminal that Americans don't care enough about their fellow Americans to take care of them. Everybody's so greedy, they only care about themselves and what they want.
I think that kind of capitalizes maybe why socialism, this is getting some favorables with the generational divide. Stephanie Mulch, can you sort of step in here?
Sure. Thanks. And thanks for having me. Well, you know, what I would say is the generational divide isn't just a sort of political and ideological thing. It has to do with people's experience. You know, I think younger generation people in this country are looking at a future where they, for the first time in generations, feel quite confident that they'll have very limited upward mobility and won't do as well as their parents. They can't buy houses. They have student loans, especially, you know, more educated students, they have to take on a burden to get there. And then they face a difficult labor market where they can't earn enough to handle loan obligations. I think it's an understandable reaction to a set of very real and very discouraging economic experiences that's affecting a particular generation.
Paul Gregory, can you talk about that? You're not a fan of socialism. Where do you think about what's happening now?
It's hard to summarize because those socialists who are running for office do not really explain what socialism is. Rather, they focus on two things. One is all the good things you're going to get for free, and the fact that it's going to be paid for by a radical redistribution of income. I found an article which traced Bernie Sanders' public statements over a long period of time, and he's been very consistent in this message. You'll get a lot of free stuff. It'll be paid for by the rich. There is very little said about what the economic system is. And if you look at the way the socialist economic system would work, it would eventually evolve and rather quickly evolve into a planned economy. And we know from experience what happens to planned economies.
Elizabeth Brunig, opinion columnist for the Washington Post. So we heard Paul Gregory's talking about one vision of what socialism is being talked about. Where do you see, what kind of socialism are we talking about?
I'm talking about democratic socialism. So I don't think anyone's actually still advancing arguments for like a centrally planned economy. I think people are either talking about market socialism or democratic socialism, where you still have active markets. The state owns some percentage of the nation's wealth. And you have, usually strong unions, high union participation, and a much broader welfare state than you have in the U.S.
So, Elizabeth Brunig, aren't we talking about just the adoption of programs that have socialism tendencies and not just the scrapping of our entire political system for socialism?
Well, our political system already has a lot in common with systems that are called socialist. I think that the Cold War, you know, so the legacy of the Cold War is imagining that socialism is this extremely foreign, exotic thing where everyone speaks Russian and the E's are backwards in all the letters. You have to build bomb shelters and so on. And everything's completely different, topsy-turvy and upside down. The reality is you go to a lot of countries in Western Europe, life's pretty similar to what it is here in the United States. And those countries consider themselves democratic socialists, or they have strong political tendencies in that direction. So we would still have democracy, we'd still be a republic, we'd still have markets, we'd still have private industry. We would just have some other stuff too. And I think that's sort of what folks like Bernie Sanders are imagining.
I'm going to call her in. The calls are already heating up here. This is Jim. And Jim, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess I have an observation. It seems like most people who are pro-socialism right now are, you know, maybe millennials who are all in a similar economic situation, owing, you know, everyone. A lot of the people that I know owe at least $10,000 in student loans. And I guess the idea is, how are all of these unestablished people, how are we going to help each other out when all of the established people, the baby boomers, seem to be against the idea? It just seems like a bunch of, you know, people who are kind of at the end of their rope financially, they're not going to be able to help each other out that much by pooling their resources.
All right, Jim, thank you for the call. Paul Gregory, in about a minute, can you kind of respond to Jim's concerns?
Well, let me respond very generally if I could.
Yes, sir.
I think the first step is to try to get a clear definition of what democratic socialism is. The one place you can find it is on the DSA website. And on the website, it shows that democratic socialism is much more than a giveaway program. It involves a community or labor control of smaller enterprises, planning for large enterprises, which is what caused me to say this will eventually lead to a planned economy. So I think we in the panel should kind of address that issue.
Okay.
What do we mean by democratic socialism?
Okay, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to dive in and, you know, try and get a definition here. What is democratic socialism? Is it locked into what the party, Democratic Socialism Party, is prescribing, or is it going to be something more? Is it flexible? Also, we want to take your calls. We're getting callers. Number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source is going to continue right after this one-minute break.
On the issue of socialism, I think if we could somehow incorporate the same ethos or public spiritedness that animates the socialism practice in, say, Sweden or even Germany, we might be able to make it work.
That's one of our callers on our voicemail line we received over the weekend preparing for this program today on The Source as we talk about socialism. What is it? Why is it having a moment now in America? As you went to break, Paul Gregory, a research fellow from the Hoover Institution and Stanford University, said, well, let's talk about what is this democratic socialism. So, Paul Gregory, well, you tell me, what do you think democratic socialism is?
Well, if I go from the Democratic Socialist site, it is an economic system which claims that profits are bad. Private ownership is bad as well. We should not produce for profit. We should produce for the social good. So someone has to define the social good. And so the question then is, who's going to define the social good? And insofar as the economy is really dominated by large concerns, some of which are transnational concerns. How are these going to be managed? And if you look at the DSA website, it says, well, we'll have to have a plan, perhaps we'll have to have an international plan supervised by the United Nations. So I think it's very important, instead of talking about tuition and free health care, we look at what the democratic socialists want as the basis of the economic system.
Okay. Stephanie Mudge, can you, sociology professor at UC Davis, author of Leftism Reinvented, what do you think we're talking about here?
You know, well, I would say two things. One is that socialism or forms of socialist movements have been around, you know, for a couple centuries now, and that's not just a matter of people's ideology. It's a matter of people's reactions to, you know, inequality, risk, competition, you know, the things that come along with markets. And democratic socialist movements, you know, have been around in various forms for a very long time in reaction to circumstances that are familiar circumstances for people today. So I would characterize it, you know, primarily as a political movement. You know, I think it's a bit puzzling to characterize democratic socialists in the United States as a strictly an economic movement. Much of what they talk about on their website is actually about democratic and electoral power. It's about, you know, it's about people being able to self-govern in the, you know, in so it's a deeply democratic movement, I would say, in the past and in the contemporary moment. You know, the other thing that I would say is I don't think, you know, the essence of socialist movements has been actually that there have been very many different conceptions of how an economy should be managed. The main principle is that economies shouldn't be managed mainly in the interests of people with wealth. I think that's a pretty consistent theme in every socialist movement you can find in the history of Western countries.
And Elizabeth Brunig, opinion columnist for The Washington Post, what are we talking about when we talk about democratic socialism?
So the DSA is not a party. It's not a political party. DSA is an organizing group. And the DSA is probably the biggest group dedicated to democratic socialism in the United States. But it, of course, didn't invent the concept of democratic socialism. Democratic socialism is a pretty broad term, and it is mainly referring to the means of change and the goal of change within a political economic system. So the means is that it's democratic. That's why the DSA is urging people to vote and urging candidates to run, because they're operating within our democratic electoral system. They're not authoritarian or totalitarian. They're not fighting anyone in the streets. They're just getting votes like everyone else. And then socialism is the goal by which they mean to use the means of democracy to achieve. So the type of socialism they're referring to, there are lots of subtypes because it's a really, really big word. It's very capacious. It's meant a lot of different things to a lot of different people over time. But what they're referring to is the members of a society having greater control over the use of the resources that the whole society produces together. Because production is not just an individual venture, because it involves all of us working together on some level, because it involves contributions and participation by everyone. Everyone should have some say, not a complete say, but some say over how those resources are used. So that's what democratic socialism is.
Okay, a lot of callers, and Julie is on the line. Julie, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. My observation is that the word itself, socialism and socialist, carry some real negative connotations to a lot of Americans. And I don't like to hear it being used, particularly in states like Texas, where that can turn people away from Democrats. What we're wanting is basic democratic ideals. We want progressive Democrats to turn out. We want Democrats to turn out. And when you attach the word socialism, that just turns people off. I think Bernie Sanders, that whole movement has hurt the Democrats by creating this false possibility in the United States. We need to come back to democratic ideals and have it at that. Let the Republicans go with what they want. They don't need to be controlling this conversation by attaching that word to Democrats.
Okay. Julie, thank you for the call. Stephanie Mudge, you're a sociology professor. Can you talk about just the meta-ness of when we talk about socialism and we're not even really able to talk about what it can do, but we're still stuck with the reactionary response to the word.
Right. Well, yeah, I think the caller has an excellent point. The term socialism, especially in the American context, has all kinds of negative connotations. And you know, there's never been in other Western countries, there have been socialist, social democratic parties that have been sort of normal parts of the political system for a long time, and that's not the case here, which has to do also, of course, with the United States' unique position during the Cold War period and its opposition to the Soviet Union. So I think it's an excellent point that the conversation doesn't need necessarily to be about socialism per se, especially since, as you can even tell from the conversation thus far, that you know everyone has a different definition of what that term means. The question is really about, you know, how should political power be organized? How should economic and productive activity be managed? How should profits be used? How distributed? What kind of power should companies or different groups in the United States have in the political system? And these are all incredibly important questions that need not be sort of diverted into a argument over the meaning of, you know, any of socialism or capitalism or anything else. These are questions that affect everybody's lives.
Elizabeth Brunig, when we hear from people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, they say things in the context of human dignity, that we should be looking for solutions, not fetishizing one particular system over the other, but something that's going to help individuals as overall through society. That needs to be part of the conversation as well, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that needs to be the entire conversation. I think we have a tendency in the United States to focus on procedures, how we get somewhere, and if the procedure is if everyone's able to have private ownership and everyone has, you know, quote-unquote equal opportunity and fair, then however the outcome ends up, then that's just. But that's sort of transparently not the case, not only because you can't create perfectly just procedures, but because the outcomes themselves in the United States, especially with lots of, you know, I think a number of children, I think a fifth or a fourth of children living in poverty, for example, people going into medical bankruptcy pretty frequently, you can see those outcomes aren't just. So I think what Sanders and AOC are saying is, why focus on the procedure? You can talk about different kinds of procedures and you can have political debates over what those procedures should be politically for getting to a goal. But overall, our focus should be on the kind of country we want to be and the kind of lives we want people to be living. And I think those are extremely important facets of politics that, oddly enough, we don't spend a lot of time on.
And Paul Gregory, can you respond?
Let me respond to the caller. I think the caller has a good point that using the word socialism, even if you put democratic in front of it, will cost some votes. Therefore, Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez have to find a way to sell this to skeptical people who don't like the word socialism. Their solution to this, Bernie's solution, is to say, I'm a democratic socialist, as if that makes a huge difference. And secondly, they say, we're going to give you a lot of free stuff. And thirdly, they're going to say, the result, if I'm elected, will not be Venezuela. It's going to be Scandinavia, as if Scandinavian countries are socialist countries. They may be social democratic, but they're not socialist. And if you look at the various indicators about economic freedom, business freedom, all those international indicators that are out there for us to measure what kind of economic system a particular country has, Sweden, Denmark, and Norway are about like the United States in some characteristics. They are more market-oriented than the United States because the United States economy is more heavily regulated than the Scandinavian economies. So this is something of a canard for the democratic socialists to promise Scandinavia when the more likely outcome, in my opinion, if this were implemented, would be Venezuela.
Why?
Because if, again, I think I'm the only economist on the panel here, but if you look at the economics of it, what they're really proposing is something called market socialism, whereby the markets run these small local economies, but planners run the large enterprises. So you get into this the planning problems, which are characteristic of the traditional socialist economies, and you're going to make a mess of things.
Okay, let me get to Stephanie Mudge to respond to that. Is that what we're talking about?
No, I don't think so.
Because we're talking about universal health care, higher education, that might be free of public universities, things like that, right?
Right. I mean, the three main items that you can see on the front page of the website for the GSA is Medicare for All, strong unions, and electoral power. There's nothing about a planned economy or having the term planners is an odd term and to my mind to characterize what they're talking about there. There's no reference to that that I see anyway. So I think the terms here, again, can be really confusing when you start talking about what country is more regulated than another. Of course, it matters what sorts of regulations you're talking about. It matters, for instance, that, the DSA has no critique of the autonomy of the Federal Reserve, of the sort of autonomy of markets in general. It's talking especially about taxation and the question of the distribution of profits. So I don't think I wouldn't say it's an accurate characterization to say they're talking about a planned economy, and I guess I'll end there.
Okay, let me read a couple of emails and we'll go to a break. We got an email from Frank. Why are people so afraid of socialism? I don't see people cringing when they hear about capitalism. They must not connect it with child labor, black lung, stolen pensions, and the rest of its excesses when it is left unregulated. There has to be a happy medium in spite of what the moneyed interests have brainwashed the middle class into believing. Also from Cliff on Twitter, my main frustration with the current discussion of socialism is portrayed as binary and not as part of the status quo. From JG on Twitter, while asking people to discuss their political opinions about socialism might be interesting, what do economists say about capitalism today? It seems we've forgotten that Marx wrote about the capitalism of his time. We're going to continue the conversation about socialism. Why is socialism having a moment today in America? Why do millennials think that we ought to be looking at socialism? Why are some people who are democratic socialists finding some space in elections and winning sometimes? The number is 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this break.
Hi there. This is David. I think socialism is probably going to do more harm than good. It will make people have incentive to work.
And I think he means not have an incentive to work. I think we may have lost a word there. But we understand what David's coming from. We're talking about socialism. Is it a good thing, bad thing? Has this word become too radioactive in our time? People are now taking another look at it. It seems to be having a moment now in America. Let's go to Paul Gregory, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. When David called in, he says that socialism is probably a bad thing, that it will probably give people not an incentive to work. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think he has a point. If everything is given away, if the essentials of life are given away free, and part of the platform is if you're unemployed, you get 100% replacement, there's a guaranteed income, and so forth. And in order to get the economic program, you have to dig deep into the website under our strategy, where they do talk about market socialism, et cetera, et cetera. So the incentive effects are there. I would focus on another incentive effect, which is what is the incentive of wealth holders to invest in an economic system in which they do not exercise control. So this means, I guess, you have to take away the wealth. The wealth goes to the government. The government then does all the investment, which to me is not a very good formula for success.
So, Paul Gregory, do you think that there could be some things that can be taken from socialistic programs and brought into a capitalistic system like we have in the United States? We have Social Security, we have public schools, public roads. These things seem to work, public libraries. You know, why not build on that and still maintain the capitalistic system that we have?
Well, there's no reason not to. If you go all the way back to Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, he does discuss those areas where the government should intervene in the economy. He called these public goods. So what one has to do is define the proper scope of public goods. And one possible compromise is for the electorate to vote for an expanded list of public goods. And this would be fully in line with Adam Smith and most of conventional economics.
And Stephanie Mudge, isn't that what we're talking about trying to do?
Yes, I would say so. It's what it sounds like to me anyway. I mean, I think the argument that people are making in the present moment is that that scope of, you know, what's considered a public good and how well they should be supported, that scope is too narrow.
Right. So when we talk about, you know, if we do have universal health care, it saves money overall for the economy. It provides higher quality health care overall. And that's could be a public good. But then Elizabeth Brunig, you know, there's still some opposition to that.
Yeah. Well, let's see. There's been a lot of conversations since I was allowed to talk.
I'm sorry about that.
It's a lot out there. Typical. It's so bizarre to say that democratic socialism in the United States would result in Venezuela when all of the economic indicators and indexes say that we're very similar to the Scandinavian economies or developed Western economies. So voting for an expanded range of public goods would probably put us in a similar situation to Scandinavia, not to Venezuela, which Venezuela melted down for a variety of reasons, none of which were directly a result of socialism. It was socialist for a long time before it melted down, and there are lots of other socialist economies in Latin America that haven't melted down. So, I mean, you know, and again, no one's even suggesting a kind of Bolivarian socialism. We're talking about a democratic socialism that's been pretty well attested in Western developed economies like Scandinavia. And so the arguments about totalitarianism and the arguments about creeping central planning, I just find really, really, really silly. And they're,
are those fear tactics?
Yeah. I mean, they're obviously fear tactics.
Because there are people who say, I say socialism, you say Venezuela. Venezuela is cray-cray because of authoritarianism and mismanagement.
Venezuela has a huge corruption problem. And Venezuela also, right, hugely mismanaged its currency, which I don't think anyone is arguing the United States should do. I don't think anyone is arguing the United States should adopt Venezuela's strange import-export policy, which was something else that helped, shutter their economy. And so, I mean, again, it's strange that on the one hand, people who say that, Scandinavia, they're already pretty much capitalist. They're very similar, then say, but if we did what they do, we would turn into Venezuela. I mean, I think you can obviously see the contradiction in terms there. I think that an expanded list of public goods is one half of what the democratic socialist vision is asking for. The other half is asking for actual control in a democracy, right? Right now, there are people in the United States so rich, they can do whatever they want politically, right? The Kochs, for example, they fund all kinds of economics departments at different universities. They fund think tanks. They have control over what goes into the discourse in terms of research and teaching at universities. And they buy politicians, right? They lobby. And then you have lots of ordinary people who don't have that kind of money, who can't buy politicians, who can't purchase think tanks or economics departments or control discourse. And they have, you know, a vote, but it's nominal. It doesn't really mean anything. And I think that what democratic socialists are saying is until we solve the inequality problem, we're not going to solve that political problem.
Okay, we've got a lot of callers, so I'm going to try and give them a chance. This is Jerry. Jerry, go ahead.
Yeah, so my question, since we have so many experts on the panel, I would like to know more about pure capitalistic countries that are very successful. So I continuously hear that socialistic countries will collapse, but I don't have very many examples of pure capitalistic countries that are just outright phenomenal.
Okay, let me get Paul Gregory a chance to respond. Go ahead, sir.
Well, it's, again, we have this problem with a lack of consensus on what's the definition. But if you look at, like, economic freedom indexes, you have Hong Kong very high. You have Singapore very high. I think you have, I don't have the list in front of me. It's very hard to find a socialist country. Again, we have this problem with definition. So I'm not going to answer the question, but I am going to say, give one statistic, say for Sweden. 90% of the Swedish economy is privately owned. If anyone would bother to dig deeply into the economic program, say of the DSA, you will see that that private ownership will be converted under this platform into cooperative, into worker-managed, and then they really don't know what to do with the large transnational corporations because they'd be too difficult to run, and you clearly get
Sure, we get that. That's what the DSA is all about, but they're not the final word on.
Of course, of course. But they're the ones who come the closest to spelling things out. And that's the problem, because they are, as was said, they are a movement. They're not a party.
Okay.
But in looking for a clear-cut definition, that's about the only place you can find it. And I suspect one reason is that Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez would not like to be caught with that economic program.
Okay. Richard is on the line. And Richard, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah. I just wanted to make some comments here very quickly. I lived in Europe for many, many years, about 10 years. I lived over there. I'm very familiar with it. I have family over there. Matter of fact, I have a son who was educated here in Texas. I'm a native Texan. Everything that is being said by Mr. Paul Gregory is just falls right into the scare tactics. There is no such thing. You look at Germany, all of Europe, Germany, Spain, England.
Okay, well, let me give Paul Gregory a chance to respond since you called him out on that. Are you using scare tactics, Mr. Gregory?
No, because we've not defined what socialism is. The European countries the caller named, I would not classify as socialist.
But they have things like they have universal health care.
Universal health care does not make an economy a socialist economy.
All right, well, we're going to hold you to that. Because that's what we hear all the time whenever we talk about trying to have programs like that. Mr. Gregory?
Yeah, but I've already made my statement.
Okay. All right, let me go to voicemail. This is one that we had earlier, and can you play it?
My name is Glenn, and given the situation with surprise billing that hospitals sometimes use and the fee-based medical system that we have in place in this country, and certainly any number of us have been hit with surprise billing when we've gone to visit a hospital or gone in for a procedure. I certainly concede the need for Medicare for all type programs, and the call for it and the popularity of it is increasing. And therefore, these things which all tie to democratic socialism are on the increase among a population that is fed up with being bankrupted by a medical industry and an insurance industry that is seen as not caring for them.
We're talking about socialism on today's Source. We've got some callers here. We can come in and call in. The number is 210-614-8980. We'll try to get you on the air. Is there a future for democratic socialism in America? Bernie Sanders was able to find a lane to run in when he sought the Democratic nomination for president. Is that lane still there? What about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? She certainly is finding national support in her bid for Congress. We're going to continue right after this break. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Vicky. My husband and I are in our mid-30s, and, you know, due to the years of neoliberal and crony capitalism that our government has partaken in, America has become an oligarchy, and there are some barriers to affordable health care, higher ed, there's stagnant wages, lack of organized labor has really led us to this place where I think younger people don't see any way out other than through social democracy or democratic socialism, whatever you want to call it. And we see the candidates who support working class policies and equality being organized under the democratic socialist banner in the U.S. This is the political platform that Bernie Sanders brought to the attention of the majority of people. You know, he is one of the most popular public servants in the U.S., poll after poll, and it's because he is speaking to the actual needs of everyday working class Americans.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about socialism showing some signs and some polling that it's gaining support. Stephanie Mudge over at the UC Davis, do you think people are just being more repelled from capitalism the way it is right now than pulled towards socialism?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. I think, you know, in the current moment in the United States, people associate capitalism with a system that's sort of working for the few and working against the many, and that isn't necessarily consistent as it's functioning at the moment with a functioning democracy, with meaningful democratic representation. I think Elizabeth said this earlier, you know, where you end up at a certain point where there's such a concentration of wealth, where you effectively undermine democratic institutions because the wealthy have so much power disproportionate over everyone else. And so I think, you know, given that situation, you know, people have now, you know, basically anybody who isn't in the top 10% of the income distribution now has a multi-generational experience or of wage stagnation and in many cases downward mobility. And in that situation, you have to expect that people at a certain point will become critical of the economic system, which is clearly not allowing upward mobility for the majority of the population.
So they feel that the economy is not working for them, not working for their generation. They thought they were playing by the rules and they should be doing better than they are. Instead, it's not, they're not where they think they ought to be despite all their efforts. So maybe the system, the economy is rigged against them. Is that what they're thinking?
Exactly. And in a way, I think we're talking about something that's very American. You know, there's a deep cultural belief in the United States, I think it's fair to say, and the idea that if you work hard and you do things right and you play by the rules, then you ought to be able to at least achieve a relatively stable middle class life. And there are many people who now not only themselves are confronting a very different reality, but they've seen their parents, you know, also have a very different experience. And you know, so you can call it socialism, but I think there's also a long American tradition of being concerned with what's fair. You know, what is fair play? What do people deserve given the effort they put in, how hard they work, and you know, what then should they be able to expect in order to live a sort of, you know, basically happy, stable, you know, life?
Okay, I'm going to go to the phones now. Alex is on the line, and he, Alex, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. I understand you're the DSA chair of San Antonio. Real quickly.
Yeah. So my name is Alex. I just wanted to get on the air to make some clarifications for the speaker, Mr. George. He's repeatedly said that definitions aren't very clear. I just want to echo what Elizabeth has said about, you know, socialism being a trend, a way that systems trend. If you materially alleviate conditions for the class, then it becomes easier for them to participate.
in things like workplace democracy. And so even though we're talking about countries which, you know, he says the majority of economic activity remains capitalist, like a Scandinavia or something of that sort, it's about moving things into the public domain so that they're not pocketbook expenses for the average person, which alleviates, you know, room for them to participate in democratic organizations. So even if those institutions are still predominantly capitalist, it's about moving things into the public domain that were previously private.
Okay, so Alex, let me ask you a question about the San Antonio DSA organization. How big are you?
So we have about 200 members.
And is it growing? Is there a trend?
Yeah, we've definitely seen an explosion, you know, that definitely fits the national trend, you know, as above, so below. We've definitely seen an explosion.
All right, Alex, thank you for the call. Paul Gregory, Alex mentioned you. Do you want to respond?
Well, the challenge I would raise is that in addition to giving away free things like health care, higher education, and so forth, what fundamental changes must be made in the way things work in the American economy? Are you going to tinker with the profit motive? Are you going to tinker with private ownership? Are you going to plan large corporations? There are two sides. You have material goods that are given away, being given away. Someone has to pay for them. Someone has to produce them. Someone has to manage all this. And so far, I haven't heard anyone explain what changes in the fundamentals of the economic system they would favor.
Okay. Elizabeth Brunig, back to you. Sorry it's taking so long. I got a lot of moving parts here. Your reaction at free things. We hear this from Paul Gregory multiple times. It's always out there that they want to be, that socialism just wants to be Santa Claus. But, you know, when there comes to giving away bailout big banks with TARP and everything else, bailing out farmers because of trade wars, seems like the money's there. We lose her? Okay. All right. And Stephanie Mudge, can you pick it up?
Hi, I'm still here.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to speak for the DSA's particular economic program, but I mean, I think there is a criticism that you will hear from various corners, not just socialist ones, about the problem of problems with the tax system and problem with corporate monopoly. In other words, where a few large corporations are bringing in a lot of are sort of dominating profits, and also with the power of finance, one of the things that we've seen recently is that when you get finance involved in the pricing of things, things that people need, things like prescription drugs and medications, the prices start getting pushed well beyond points where people can actually pay. So, and that's, you know, that's a problem. So I think that, you know, there are certain basic economic policy questions that I don't know if they're actually perfectly clear in the program of the DSA, but there is a critique, I think, of monopoly and of the sort of pricing of things that maybe should be public goods or should be considered public goods beyond people's reach. And there's obviously also a criticism of the taxation system. When you have a tax system that isn't nearly as progressive as it used to be, and, you know, this is, again, like a reason to move to historical examples rather than talking sort of abstractly about what socialism is. Here in the United States, we used to have a pretty aggressive taxation system in which wealthier people paid much more than they do now as a percentage. And also, you know, we now have a taxation system that's moved away from taxing that doesn't tax a huge part of the income to the wealthy, which is through financial profits. You know, in that world, then you have to start thinking about both dealing with corporate power, corporate monopoly, the way that things are priced beyond that, public goods anyway, or things that should be public goods are priced beyond people's means to pay for them, and whether or not the taxation system is working in such a way such that people who have the vast majority of wealth in the United States are essentially paying lower rates of tax.
Okay.
Right, than middle class and wage-earning people.
But so, Elizabeth Brunig, I understand you're back now?
Sorry about that.
That's no worries. And so essentially we're trying to get to, in this conversation, is talking about the word socialism and whether or not we can just sort of start talking about it without having our hair on fire and hyperventilating. Are we getting there?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, people worry about free stuff. It's not free stuff. It's paid for by taxes. Taxes are going to come from a lot of really rich people who aren't really paying their fair share of taxes at this point. It's going to go down the income scale as well. And there's also going to be a lot of tax credits that go away. There's a lot of welfare right now that just goes to rich people. These are tax credits that primarily go to well-to-do families and well-to-do people. They claim them on their taxes every year. Poorer people, normal people, don't even have the opportunity to claim these tax loopholes and these tax benefits, but they're a major loss of revenue for the government. And so we would shut all of those down. I mean, these are already very, very well-to-do people. They're not going to be suffering if they pay their fair share of taxes. Same thing with corporations, and that's how we're going to fund these things. So no, it's not being given away, right? But it's not also going to put people...
Okay, we lost her. So, Paul Gregory, you get the last word. Where do you think this is going?
Who knows? I would just go very briefly into history, and that is, if you look at the Socialist Party of Eugene Debs and Norman Thomas, they were very frank about their economic and political program. They just laid it all out. It's basically revision Marxism.
Yeah, but that's not what we're talking about.
I understand, but they got 3% of the, they would get 2-3% of the vote. So it's my suspicion that once the economic program of the Democratic Socialists is known, I would say it would become a peripheral fringe political movement.
Okay. All right, Paul Gregory, thank you so much for joining us. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Also with us this afternoon, Stephanie Mudge, sociology professor, expert on socialism, social democracy. She's at UC Davis. Her book is Leftism Reinvented, Western Parties from Socialism to Neoliberalism. Also with us is Elizabeth Brunig, opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Many thanks to all of our callers. Sorry we couldn't get you all on the air today. Obviously, this is a topic that people care about. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.